truth, unchanged from the dawn of time. I don't think I can live up to that. Echoing down from eternity. Man, what a grand thought. But we're going to look at a text tonight from Titus chapter 3. I guess I often say, and still do it, that I don't like introductions in which a speaker shares the struggles of how to pick a topic with the audience. It seems to me we ought to be smarter than that and just pick something and do it. But I want you to know that I was listening to a sermon on a totally unrelated topic from the Old Testament, actually, and the speaker made a reference to Titus chapter 3, and it kind of struck a chord with me, a little bit like the lesson this morning. Now, after the lesson this morning, I think that's a stronger chord than the lesson tonight, than not be weary in well-doing. So I'm not sure I have enough well-doing even to be weary in, but still, that lesson, of course, stands out, and it relates a little bit to Titus chapter 3. But the speaker was talking about living in a very difficult time. Sodom and Gomorrah was actually the topic that he was talking about. And he kind of made the point that, yes, they were an evil society. And we sometimes look at the world around us in our American culture and bemoan how distant and how unspiritual and immoral and ungodly and how evil is glorified. And we think, boy, we really have it, we have it rough. But his point was this, that in the first century, especially in the early days of the gospel, in some of those early places, Asia Minor and Greece, and in this case, Crete, Christianity came as an outside stranger. It wasn't like they'd had it and it had decayed over several hundred years to where they'd forgotten what they knew. Do you see what I mean? This was something totally new, outside their understanding altogether. And think of the difference there. Now, this is the point in the sermon where most of the time, the speaker would begin to go through the litany of all that's wrong with America, right? We've just come off a weekend of two shootings, and we could talk about the pundits and politicians rushing to the microphones to blame each other for that, and the kind of lack of civility in the marketplace, and lack of honesty, and disregard of laws, and the corporate greed, and all the things, and the glorification of immorality. Have you heard introductions to sermons like that before? If you have, insert that here, all right? Because that's kind of what we're talking about. What I do want to talk about, though, is Titus, who was left in Crete, and the challenge he had there on that island. And the way we'll approach this is to talk about the background of both Titus, briefly, and the Cretans themselves, the culture that was there, as a kind of an introduction to the challenge that the Christians probably faced. I'll do an overview of the letter to Titus, and then I want to look in chapter 3 in particular at what Titus is told to preach to the Cretans about their relationship to authorities and everyone, all men, he says. And then ask the question, how and why could the Christians live this way with regard to everyone on the island of Crete? How could that be? And I think we ought to be bewildered by that at first and have explained to us by the Holy Spirit in the book of Titus. So if you haven't done it, you turn to the book of Titus. We'll focus on chapter 3. I did a little search to see if the book of Titus had been the topic of many sermons in the past. It may have been, but I couldn't find it by searching for the word Titus. Maybe you remember a lesson. Maybe it was one last week that I forgot, but I hope not. But there might be. It's okay if I did. But I wondered to myself, why was chapter 3 something we haven't really preached on much? And I think the answer is pretty obvious, and that is there are other texts. Romans 13 is one. 1 Peter 2 is another. And several others. You can think 1 Timothy 2, that are a little bit more detailed. The language in Titus is very sparse. It's very compact, one commentator said. And so what you'll see in chapter 3 is just kind of like boom, 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 without a lot of explanation, but still very challenging words. And so I think we often tend to go to Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2 when we talk about our relationship to authority. Great text for sure. But I'd like to try to limit myself to Titus, and I won't really succeed, but I'll do more of that. And I challenged myself when I heard that lesson on Titus 3. Could you just go to Titus 3 and make a sermon out of that? Or study it and try to make an application to your life just from that text, as if you were a resident of Crete and getting that letter from the Apostle Paul. And by the way, I would just say that the letter was written to the churches in Crete. Obviously, there were several churches across that island. We'll say more about it. But one thing that's always struck me, or since I figured it out, noticed it, the last verse says, "Grace be with you all." Amen. It's clear that the letter was written for all to read, and you can imagine the excitement when a letter from Paul arrives to this evangelist Timothy. And as he went from church to church, I could imagine him saying, "I got one. I got another one. And I want you all to read it." So as he goes through, sure enough, it's instructions to him about what he's supposed to preach. But no doubt, those in the audience were listening with a lot of attention to the words, the very words of the Apostle Paul by inspiration. So let's talk about Titus, first of all. Titus, strangely enough, is not mentioned in the book of Acts, even though it's pretty clear he had been a companion of Paul from the very beginning. He is mentioned in Galatians, which, you know, describes some of their early things, perhaps even before the missionary journeys, as we call them. Later, it's clear that he had some role with Paul, as he's written about in 2 Corinthians, in collecting the gifts and going to Corinth. And then here we find him, apparently, between the two imprisonments, if that's what happened, but after the first imprisonment, where Paul has given him an assignment to go to Crete. So Titus was around a lot, but never really mentioned by name in the book of Acts. He was Greek. We know that from Galatians 2, and the reason that's important is because he eventually became a test case with regard to circumcision. I'll point that out in just a minute. He was a close companion of Paul. "If anyone inquires about Titus," Paul said, 2 Corinthians 8, "he is my partner and fellow worker concerning you." Close relationship. And he was a test case in that early controversy over circumcision. He was kind of caught in the middle, traveling with Paul, a pure Greek, uncircumcised person. Did he need to be circumcised to be accepted by the church, by Christians, to be an evangelist, to be a companion of Paul? And Paul says, "No, not even Titus, who was with me, being a Greek, was compelled to be circumcised." I don't know what that would do to you in your life to be a kind of a center of the controversy, but he was early on. He was a man apparently of high integrity. Paul talks in several ways about that in 2 Corinthians, mostly in chapter 8. It's clear he was one of those entrusted with the gifts for Judea, and I believe he was selected then by several churches or by one church to carry their particular gifts, the way that was mechanized at the time. And then Paul says, "Thanks be to God who puts the same earnest care for you into the heart of Titus." Similar words are said of Timothy in Philippians, but apparently a man of great conviction and a concern for others. And then Paul mentions his deep emotional connection. Interesting, two contrasting verses in 2 Corinthians 2. "I had no rest in my spirit," Paul says, chapter 2, verse 13, "because I did not find Titus, my brother." I guess he was waiting for news that Titus would bring, and that absence of news was a concern for him. And then later, he says, "Nevertheless, God, who comforts the downcast, comforted us by the coming of Titus." So, one of those guys you like to see him coming, and it made the Apostle Paul happy and comforted him when he did show up. In contrast to Timothy, he may have been a little bit more courageous. These things are said about him. It says, "But as we spoke all things to you in truth, even so our boasting to Titus was found true. His affections are greater for you as he remembers the obedience of you all, how with fear and trembling you received him." Interesting that he actually was a source of fear for others. And then in chapter 8, verse 17 of 2 Corinthians, "He not only accepted the exhortation, but being more diligent, he went to you of his own accord, showing some initiative." I only say that briefly, and maybe we'll have a sermon more fully on the character of Titus later. But I just say that Titus was the man for the job because it was a tough job to go to Crete and do the work that Paul had given him to do, leaving him there, actually. I'll just throw this in. It looks as if he may have left him there alone amongst all those churches and problems, which we'll talk about in just a minute. But it looks like at the end of the book, the very end, in fact, I guess verse 13 of chapter 3, 12, it looks like Paul has in mind sending some relief to him, Artemis and somebody else, to give him a break. So there may have been a way in which he was expecting some relief. The island of Crete is found there in the Mediterranean Sea. You can see it's kind of just between Greece and Asia Minor, which is shown in the light colors there. It's about, I think, maybe 150 miles long, and it varies in width from maybe 8 to 30 miles. So long, narrow island. It's very mountainous, three large peaks there over 8,000 feet, at least one of them. There are ports along the northern side, and maybe that's due to weather. You remember there was an incident in Acts, I think chapter 27, where Paul was in that ship and he was traveling along the southern edge of Greece, of Crete, and there wasn't any, maybe not a place to land, but it's just not a very hospitable place there. And so they didn't stop, maybe they should have, and ended up in a shipwreck there. But Crete's mentioned in that navigation sense. And maybe Paul valued the churches there in Crete because they were a centerpiece, maybe a place where people would be coming and going, a place the gospel could be spread from as well. It's maybe the case that the gospel came to Crete from Jews who were converted at Pentecost. Speculation, but there were people from Crete mentioned in Acts chapter 2 on the day of Pentecost, and perhaps they returned. It does seem clear there was a Judaizing influence, not good, there in Crete, that whoever was there, in this case Titus, had to deal with. So what can we say about Cretan society, and maybe even the Christians there? Now this is the part that would be scary to me, to all of us, as a preacher, or even going there as a Christian looking for a place to worship. It was a Greek island. It was under Roman rule at that time. In fact, it had come under Roman rule in the 60 BC time frame. It was actually part of the state, the area that was also included in northern Africa, the way Rome divided up the various regions. It was known for dishonesty. It was known for greed, for immorality, for insubordination. And I could quote a lot of the literature of the day and the history of the day to give you some ideas about that. I don't think I need to. We're going to find it right in the book itself, this evidence that Paul was talking about. I'll mention a few things. One idea was that because they were proud of the fact that they thought they were the birthplace of Zeus, who was a kind of a clever, scheming, conniving god, maybe they kind of thought that was the way you ought to live, borrowed maybe from those imperfect gods that they had created. Well, one idea. I wonder, too, if you live on an island far away from whatever Greece or Roman rule you have, you tend to be somewhat insubordinate because you have a little bit of natural isolation on the island. I don't know, but they were known for that. In fact, there's a word, in the Greek, kritismos, I think it is, which is taken from the word for Crete, and it means to lie. It's actually the word to lie. So they were famous for their untruth, and I think we'll see in the book itself a theme about truth-telling that comes out over and over in the way Paul talks about it. Telling the truth or using your speech in a good or healthy way. Anyway, that's the state there. But Paul quotes Epimenides, I think is the guy's name. I'm not a scholar of Epimenides. I think that's the right name. But he quotes him in the book and says this, and he says this is a true statement. Even though all Cretans are liars, this guy got it right when he said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. There are probably four different points there. One is this disregard for truth. You know, it's just easy to lie. That's the way some cultures really get along. That's the way they dicker with each other in the marketplace, right? That's the way they interact, to take advantage of one another. And there really is no appreciation of truth. There's no sense that I'm going to get the truth, and there's no sense that I have a requirement to tell the truth. I think we have that going on somewhat in our country, but probably not to this extent. They're evil beasts. Interesting thought about that is, one commentator said that, there was a historian who said that, this is an island, and maybe they had over the years killed off all the predatory beasts, the wolves and lions and other things. So there weren't any animals to be afraid of, but it was still covered with evil beasts. And who do you think those were? That would be the people who lived there. Cruel or violent, threatening, a dangerous place to live in a kind of a dog-eat-dog, survival-of-the-fittest kind of environment. And then lazy. And I think lazy is another theme that comes out in the negative. The term for good works or works of some kind or another is found throughout all of Titus. In fact, we'll find it three times in the short verses that we'll look at. I think maybe seven different times, including works that show that you don't believe in God, but also good works that we should be full of. We'll find that three times in the text we'll look at, perhaps in contrast to someone who doesn't work at all. And then finally, gluttons, those who are driven. I think literally bellies is what that says, lazy bellies. They're just bellies. Bellies take in stuff, food in particular. They're satisfied. That's what they're about, is to eat and to be satisfied based on our lust. And so that's the idea. a few interesting little points. I'm not sure this is valid, but it just occurred to me. In the Titus description of the qualification of elders, and by the way, that may be the main reason we ever look at Titus, right? Titus 1 is the qualification of elders. But there's this requirement that the elders' children not be accused of riot or insubordination. Do you know that that's not found in Timothy's account, 1 Timothy 3, Timothy there at Ephesus? I don't know if that's a significant thing or not. A similar requirement, which is the ruling their house well, but here in Crete, maybe that was a problem. In that the children, of course, maybe the letter written in the 60s, maybe the church had been there for 20 years or so, but it would very likely be the case that it would be difficult to find a man whose children were not involved in the society around them. I actually was hoping the qualification not double-tongued was also, that would fit with the idea of liars. And I couldn't find it. It's not in there. And then I said, well, it must be in 1 Timothy, right? No, it's not there either. It's actually the qualification of the deacons. Sorry, that's just a footnote. That cost me 10 minutes of study time to try to find it. Where's the double tongue thing? But it's a deacon qualification. But it would have fit. There are key themes then in Titus. Truth-telling, because they're all liars, and they're lazy. So good works will come up quite often in the book. He says in chapter 1, verse 13, that their minds and consciences are defiled. They deny God by their works, chapter 1, verse 14. There's an emphasis on the word works. They're abominable, disobedient, disqualified for good works, verse 14. And I just have to tell you, those last few verses do not describe the general culture. They're really telling about some of the people in the church who were destroying the Christians there. And you know what had happened was the culture had been imported by means of these leaders into the church there. And in the church, there were many insubordinate or rebellious, is another translation, chapter 1, verse 10. And what does he say about them? They're idle talkers, similar, deceivers, and for dishonest gain. And doesn't that fit with the general culture that he quotes Epimenides to describe? And what is Titus doing there? For this reason, because of all this, for this reason I left you in Crete, that you should set in order the things that are lacking. What a challenge to try to address this culture. And I think we sometimes think we have it bad. I'll never forget. Sewell said it over and over, so I won't forget. And someone says, you know, somehow or another, the doctrine of Christ doesn't fit in our times. And you know the punchline is, it never fit in any time. And that's certainly true in the first century, and certainly true on the island of Crete, and I think in many ways we're not even close to the kind of culture that Titus had to address there on the island of Crete. Let's talk about the letter. It's fairly short. It's only three chapters. This is really handy. It all fits on one opening in my Bible. I don't even have to worry about turning the page. And I hope that's true for you too. But let's look at an overview of the letter. Paul begins typically with an introduction, but notice the emphasis on truth-telling in this introduction. I'd like to read that to us. At short, Paul, a bondservant of God and apostle of Jesus Christ, according to the faith, we studied that in our doctrinal study, the faith of God's elect in the acknowledgement of the truth which accords with godliness, in hope of eternal life which God, who cannot lie, promised before time began, but has in due time manifest his word through preaching, which was committed to me according to the commandment of our God and Savior. To Titus, a true son in our common faith. You see, many of the references, as we've talked about in the Essential Doctrines class, all those different words, probably five different ones there that describe the root of this faith that they have in common, that he says I have in common with Titus, is based on preaching, on truth, on the word from God. And so that's the basis of the arguments, and that's the basis of Titus's role there. After that, there's a discussion of the qualifications of leaders. Why that's first, I don't know for sure, but it could be that these Judaizing teachers had the leadership role in many of these churches and had to be displaced. Whose mouths must be stopped is one of the phrases that he used. So based on Scripture, is what we'll see, these leaders need to be put in place, but not just anyone. The leadership needed to be based on character. Not power, not political might, not family history, not how long you've been a member of the church, not on wealth, not on some political basis, but on character. That was the heart of what these leaders needed to be, which then would enable them, by their knowledge of the Word, which they had learned, he says in chapter 1, to put to silence those who had been teaching falsely, and really leading people astray, overthrowing households, I think is the phrase that he uses, a great danger. So the first thing that Titus is told is to get leaders who meet these qualifications in every place. It's interesting to me that there would be. I should just say a little bit about that. Sometimes we think that in a terrible society, a church maybe that had only been there for 10 or 20 years, how would they ever find elders? They had them here. I don't think Paul was writing this just to show how impossible it would ever be to have elders. But he was saying, look, these are the men you need to find out, and surely there were some who needed to take on the role of leaders. And then in chapter 2, he begins to describe the character of Christians, and he goes through a list of older and younger men and women. Older men, older women, younger men, younger women, not necessarily in that order, and then also lists the responsibilities of servants. And after describing the proper behavior for each of these kinds of people and the roles in their life, he stops to say why. And you should look at chapter 2, verse 11. He says, "For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men." And that's a very familiar text because we read it. It's such a great blessing, an overview of the gift of Jesus. And he says, that's the reason you live this way. It's very similar to arguments made in other epistles that say because of what God has done for us, he's redeemed us from every lawless deed and purify himself, his own special people, zealous for good works. The reason you live this way is because of what Christ has done for us. He did this for you to prepare you for good works. There's our theme again, lazy versus good works. And so the reference then to this scheme of redemption, which is incorporated here, the why, if you will, has to do with living up to the gift that God has given us. The reason I say that is because a similar section is found in our text for tonight, and that is Titus chapter 3. And that is the behavior toward others. And it does seem that in chapter 3, verse 1, he turns his attention a little bit away from the way the Christians would live in their families and with regard to each other, to the way they have to interact with the society, the evil society around them. And that's what seemed relevant to me. This is a lesson I need. I have failed at what Titus chapter 3 says, and it's all of its terseness. It nevertheless speaks eloquently to my shortcomings. And we have this behavior that we're to have toward others, rulers and authority, and finally just says to all men. And then there's another why. Again, another for, F-O-R, in verse 3. For we ourselves were also once foolish, disobedient, deceived. And you see then again another description of the salvation that came from God through grace. Things that we don't deserve. I'll come back and show you, I think that's a little bit of a difference in why that reference is there. And then there's a conclusion in the latter part of the letter where I think he says, I'm going to send you some relief as well. So what is chapter 3 telling us? It's not long. Really, the bulk of the content's in the first two verses. So let's talk about what that is. First thing he says is, chapter 3, verse 1, remind them to be subject to rulers and authorities, to obey, to be ready for every good work. I'm comforted that he says remind them. I don't think I have anything to say tonight that you haven't heard before. And I think reminding is maybe a lot of what preaching should be about, to motivate us to do what we already know to do. But let's notice what he says that they're supposed to do. The first thing is, with respect to rulers and authorities, is to be subject to them. And that word is really to be in submission. And it's the very same word that's used in chapter 2 with regard to wives in verse 5 and with regard to servants in verse 9. It's no different. It's a kind of obedience that has to do with the way they relate to each other. So at the very outset, at the very minimum, there's no place for insurrection, for civil disobedience, for treasonous actions, for actions that would tend to overthrow the government in some way, to be submissive. And I have to say by analogy, if a wife was always trying to undermine her husband in some way, or a servant always, in fact, he mentioned servants are not purloining or not being dishonest in some way, trying to hurt their master, it, by analogy, if our actions are intended to undermine the government in some way, that's the opposite of what he's saying here. He's asking us to do that. So at the very minimum, it's there. And I have to stop and say, do you know who the Emperor of Rome was at this time? In the 60s, you probably know this. It's Nero. Nero the immoral, Nero the cruel, Nero the without natural affection emperor, the one who initiated the beginning of the persecution of Christians across the world. You know this story too, but that's who he's talking about in this text. As well as the wherever the local people were, and you can just be sure there was pretty corrupt. I'm sorry about these glasses. I left my good ones at home. These were Mary's. I think her reading glasses, and so I don't know if they look strange or not, but it's my backup plan. But I can't see with them. Can we get that off the tape? Anyway. But I think it's more than just not being traitors or not being somehow rebels or starting revolutions or something. I think it's more than that. I think it's, back on the idea of being in submission, I think it's not a begrudging, kind of a passive-aggressive compliance, if you make me do it, I'll do it. Is that the kind of submission you would characterize, you would want to characterize a wife's submission to her husband? In the ideal, it's a joyful fulfilling of his leadership. If he has an idea or a plan, can I carry that farther? Can I use my own judgment and initiative and energy to support that plan if it's good? I have to conclude that from the use of the word itself, to be in subjection. And it may also carry the idea of maybe going further than is required. Just like when Jesus said, if someone asked you to carry a load a certain distance, why don't you go double that? Not necessarily people who care much for you or are very kind or really have much of a moral character about them. And yet, we willingly go and carry it further if it's a good thing to do. Second thing he says, which seems similar in a way, is to obey. And that Greek word is a compound word that really means the first part of the root is to persuade, but it's used in the passive voice, which is to be persuaded by rank, is kind of the idea. Put those two words together and it's saying, because someone is over me, I'm going to be convinced by that, and I'm going to be submissive based on that. So it's the idea of obeying, in some translations will say the authorities, and they're trying to convey this idea of that double Greek word, which is I'm going to be submissive because of rank, because of the position of someone in authority. And that could be a parent, it could be a teacher, it could be a local magistrate, it could be a policeman who pulls me over, it could be any of those, but I'm going to be persuaded and respectful based on that. And of course that respect comes from God's rule. And I would just say, I always think of Pilate, who said to Jesus, don't you know I have power of life and death over you? And Jesus said, yeah, I'm aware of that. He didn't say that. He implied, yeah, that's true. But how did you get that? It came from God. And that hierarchy of God being kind of the final authority that put everybody in place is the reason that we're persuaded by rank, if that's the way we should translate that word. And it's not based on cultural practice. I think that's a big mistake we make sometimes. Do you think the culture of Crete was one that just always obeyed all the magistrates? I think it's true even today that Greece is kind of famous for not ever paying taxes, especially the wealthy people. And it's put them in a bad place nationally with debt and everything else. And you know a lot of the countries in the world this way are that way. There's an underground economy. We make our money. We don't pay our taxes. And everybody does it. That's why it's okay. Because everybody does it. You see what he's saying here? No, that's not the reason. It's because of their rank that we obey, not because everybody's kind of compliant in the culture. That's what he's doing. So it's not based on cultural practice, especially in a corrupt society where lying was a way of life and stealing was the way that you got ahead. And I think for us, simple things like our neighborhood covenants, our city ordinances, maybe has to do with where we park or littering, or I would mention traffic laws, but again, I'll be too condemning of myself to do that. But paying our taxes, working under the radar and not declaring our income in some type of an economy that's not reported. The way we conduct our business, and we know something really is illegal, even maybe unethical, and we still do it. Why? Because everyone else does it. That's just the way business is conducted. If I can collaborate on fixing a price or something like that. Immigration laws, things that have to do with substances that we shouldn't have, those kind of things. Do you sense in this there should be a care among Christians to be compliant in every way? Not because the laws are good and right in every case, but because they have an order that has God at the top in their origin. And so I think maybe a way to think about this would be that as the world of the Cretans looked at the Christians, they would have to be surprised at the level of compliance. That's what I kind of see. Look over in chapter 2, verse 9. Here servants are to be obedient, well-pleasing in all things, not answering back, not stealing or pilfering, showing... Why is that? That they may adorn the doctrine of God our Savior in all things. I think a very similar thing here. Our compliance with laws should be striking. It should be surprising. And people say, why are you so careful about that? That's kind of strange. And the reason is because we're, as he says here, we're adorning the doctrine, chapter 2. And then, here we are again with our theme of work. And I'm going to postpone a little bit the discussion of what good works are till later. But that's it. You should be ready for every good work. And then in chapter 3, verse 2, he turns it, it seems to me, to all men. To speak evil of no one. Boy, there's a challenge. No one? Really? Even the despicable people among us? The immoral that are on in the entertainment? The politicians who are clearly corrupt or who don't disagree with me? Even the stupid things that people say, the worldly things, the evil things that people say, even liberals, you know? I mean, are we supposed to, is that true? Speak evil of no one? And how could we ever do that? Well, certainly in person we wouldn't speak evil of someone. And there's a much Bible teaching about that. Jesus says, you know, bless those that curse you. So there's a sense of always returning a favorable response. But I wonder sometimes if our avatars in social media, is that the right word to use? Does that make... You know, it's not really me, but it's my avatar. It has a picture of me, but it's saying all these things on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and those other things. But it's coming out. I wonder if that's included, speaking evil of no one in that environment. It's especially easy to speak evil of those who are not present or whom I'm not looking at directly in the face, isn't it, when we say those things? And you know, I think there, especially now in our culture, there's an industry built around people who really, in a way, speak evil of the other side. And that's what they do. And people find it entertaining and perhaps find it also as a role model. This is the point probably when you make the point like this that you have to stop and say, now I'm not saying. I just don't like that. It's almost as if we have to come to some kind of balance. Now, here earlier in the book, Paul has actually said some pretty harsh things about these teachers that have done harm in the church and whose mouths need to be stopped. And he even kind of talks about their motives. And I don't know fully how to reconcile that. Except he knew he said that, and he said this too, so somehow they have to be reconciled. But I think part of the answer is this. Their motives were clear from their actions, and so he could say that. And second, the answer was not to be hateful and speak evil of them in the sense of judging their motives in some unfair way, but rather to address it with the Word of God. It seems to me that's the area where we can have confidence. If someone has a different view than I do on some political issue, I don't have much confidence. None of you should, that you really know the right answer to that. You know this is a complex world. But when it comes to truth, I think I do know the answer. And the way I deliver it is important. Of course, I'm not saying, I'm not going to give exceptions. We deliver it in love. That's what we do. And we can be firm about it. But it has to do with the truth, not some issue that I have no clue really what the right answer would be with regard to name your issue. Gun control, whatever. We'll list a few in a minute so I can be politically incorrect, I guess. And so, Paul's criticism is aimed at the opponents of truth who were subverting households and the way it was to be addressed with the sound doctrine. The next thing he says is to be peaceable. And that word is actually the negative of another word in the Greek, which is don't be a fighter. Be a non-fighter is one way to think about that. Don't be someone who's just looking to fight all the time. And don't we love a fight in a way, especially an intellectual fight, especially if it's our avatars out in front and it's not really us talking and the whole world is watching maybe. But I'm so good at the zingers, you know, and the way to put an insult in there or show that somebody misspelled a word and therefore they must not have had an education beyond the eighth grade. You know, or something that... And so generally a fight is about winning and not about arriving at truth. That's a kind of a hint to how to tell whether this is good or bad. It's really about winning. And winning often then becomes about showing the other person to be inferior in some way, somehow making me superior. So I think there's a couple of questions you could ask in any discussion. Am I interested in winning or figuring out what the truth is? And second of all, is this turning to be an attack on the person as opposed to a discussion of the issue? So those are things, I think, that come out of this. And so arguments then generally often turn to be aimed at a person. Be gentle. And the word could be mild, it could be patient. All that I could tell from the commentators is that there's not a really good English word for this. There's not enough. It takes a bunch of words to fully understand the depth of it. But isn't it true that often the calmer person is more persuasive, maybe by their calmness? And it should be a hallmark. And actually, look, the elders have a not quick temper, not violent. Those were part of their toolbox then for convincing these false teachers that they were wrong. Was their character non-violent, non-fighters, I guess is the right way to say it. If they were gentle, mild, and patient has to do with that. So that should be a hallmark of the way we talk and the way we argue. And then showing humility. Do you see how these are getting harder? I mean, in a way, it's getting more and more inside my character to say, okay, don't say anything bad, right? But really, in fact, don't get into fights when you don't need to be. Be gentle. And then finally, my character comes out, and that is a humility. It's a humility that reminds us that we don't even actually know a lot of things. We have a lot of limits, right? And we don't know about other people's motives. And the world is pretty complex when I can be very absolute and shouldn't be about things. And it reminds us, and I wasn't going to make references, but 2 Timothy 2 talks about the Lord's servant not striving. And he describes the way we should view other people, which is what we're coming up to here in Titus as well. And then I'm going to jump down a little bit, down to verse 9, past the why text, and say that we should avoid foolish disputes. And he lists some of those, genealogies and other things, but generally just things that are not worth arguing over. What could those be? Do you argue, or a lot of times it's easier to talk with somebody who agrees with you, and then you just pile on each other, right? About how evil this other group is, or how stupid they are, how little they know, how right we are, and so we build up that. I guess I would ask this question. If we could do statistics on your conversations, what would be the primary topics? And whatever those topics are, is that because that's the most important thing? Are those controversies, searching for truth, convincing other people about that, are they more important than the gospel? And convincing sinners that they're lost and they need the salvation of Jesus, is that right? And that's in our conversations. You know, I'm going to talk about now our avatars on Facebook. If I look at my posts and just do a statistical analysis, is it saying something about what's important to me in my life? About what issues are critical to me in some way, that I think I know the truth that other people need to know? What would it say about me if I look at those posts or my retweets or my reposts or my likes, if those are my statistics about my character? Is it about the gospel? Or is it about corporate corruption, or the deep state, or immigration policy, or the welfare state, discrimination, terrorism, gun rights, fair housing, obscenity and entertainment, animal protection, environment, trade tariffs, educational inequality, homeschooling, homelessness, health care, government defense of immorality? I don't mean to say that these are irrelevant issues, but that's not the gospel right there. It's getting the government to fix all those things. Do you see that? And I'm afraid that as we look at the statistics of what we do argue about, some of these are foolish disputes. And frankly, with regard to immoral media or gun control or terrorism or mass shootings, I don't know what the answer is. I don't know. And I'm fooling myself if I think I know in some absolute sense that requires some sense of temper or absolutism or attack of an opponent on that. I don't think you know either. So, foolish disputes. What makes something foolish is it's not the heart of what we're here to do. It's not the heart of what we live for. And so, right or wrong, you know, what do these say about our priorities, and do they compare to the gospel message? And finally, being careful or ready, devoting ourselves, leading in, or different ways to translate this, good works. We're back to good works again. And I hope you noticed that we found that in verse 1, to be ready for every good work. We found it in verse 8, to maintain good works. And we're going to see it again in verse 14. It says, people learn to maintain good works to meet urgent needs. And I need to figure out what good works is. And on my notes early on, I said, what are good works? Big letters with a big question mark. And I still don't know what the easy answer to that is. It's always helpful if you find a verse that explains it. And then I saw Russ was going to be talking about do not be weary in well-doing. And I thought, good, he's going to cover that for me in the morning lesson. What are good works? And Russ is going to define it. And he had a start. He said, well, it's overcoming temptations, a start, right? Help me, Russ. And then, you know, other helping people, including non-Christians, mentioned that. But I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what good works are not, and then what they are, based on Titus, and maybe we can draw some conclusions. What are not good works? Well, any disobedience or disrespect or malice or envy or deceit, I kind of knew those were not good works. And it's in that context that he's saying, don't be doing that. It's anything, chapter 2, verse 5, now this is back in the relationship section of Titus, that causes blasphemy of the word. So when you think about an action, and if someone could say, wait, you're a Christian? I thought you believed this or that. And they look at your behavior and they say, I don't think that's the truth because you're not living anything like that. That would be something in that category. So it may be the way we dress or where we go or the slogans on our t-shirts or something like that, but anything that would cause the word to be blasphemed, chapter 2, verse 5. Anything that causes condemnation or criticism of us by opponents, that's what he says in chapter 2, verse 8, related to younger men and their activities. It would be contention about irrelevant or vain issues, as we just saw in chapter 3, verse 9. And then he goes on in verse 10 to say that a factious man refused. So anything that's divisive behavior. I think I can rule those out. Although sometimes we think about debating and arguing and put that in the category of something that's a good work. But those are things that are not good works. Here are some things he says that are good works. To younger men, he says, be a pattern of good works. In doctrine, show an integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, sound speech. And there's that reference to the use of the tongue again. That cannot be condemned. You know, there are things we can say that the vilest people or the highest enemies of Christianity really can't complain about that. I think that's what he said. Aim for that kind of thing. And he's saying that to younger men. That's an interesting thing to me. Can younger men begin to talk things that say that they know about the doctrine, they have sound doctrine, they are reverent toward God, that they themselves are incorruptible? What a challenge. So those would be things. Speaking in a way that in some way as the servants were to do adorns the doctrine and with our own character consistent. And then something that puts the opponent to shame. Not by embarrassing them, not by insulting them, but rather because they would love to say something evil about you, but they can't find anything. And they're kind of embarrassed when they talk about you and your character is such, they're just embarrassed to criticize you. That's how you put them to shame. Not by that zinger, right? That shows how silly they are, but rather by our conduct. So that's a good work, setting an example. Things that are good and profitable to men, chapter 3, verse 8, I think characterizes that. Something that's uplifting in the society in some way. And I'll just insert a little personal editorial. I don't think it's necessarily about national initiatives. To a large extent, national initiatives are about the state doing it, and I'll just pay a little money and they'll do it all for me. I think this is local. This is very personal. And that's what he's talking about. Profitable men on a personal level. What can I do to address this problem that's right here in my family or that's right here in my neighborhood? It seems like that would be the theme there. And let our people learn to maintain good works to meet urgent needs, he says in chapter 3, verse 14. So that's pretty clear. If there's an urgent need that you're aware of, and I assume that's a physical need, be a worker to actually meet that need. You know, there's another translation of that term, maintain good works. In fact, some versions have this. And it's good works meaning honest work. Meaning, keep up a good job and get some income. Why? And if you read that text, you can see that it has to do with, the context is, supporting some men that they're going to send on the way. I think that makes sense. Look at verse 14 more closely. He's saying, These men, I want you to send them on their way, and maybe you have to have honest work to be able to do that. It reminds me of I think 2 Thessalonians 3, where he says, eat your own bread, and the idea that you need to work, honest living, pay for your own way. And by the way, the next verse in that text also says, and do not be weary in well-doing. It's interesting that kind of well-doing, work honestly, so that you can, as Ephesians says, have something to give those who are in need. So it may just be honest employment. And I think that's a good work in this context because it enables the other good works and the resources that are there. Now, remember, we're talking about living right. Don't forget the context. He's saying this is the way we live toward all those terrible people in our culture around us who've denied God, who are liars, and cheaters, right? And they're cruel. How can I live that way toward them? And so I want to ask the question, how and why? And remember the why passages. We saw one in chapter 2, and now we're going to see this other one in chapter 3. We kind of skipped over those verses. And it's because what God has done for us. What he says is, for, remember that you once were. We were once this thing. And it seems to me that we have to look with wisdom at those around us in this way to say, that's the way I used to be. And how does he describe how I used to be? Foolish, disobedient, deceived, enslaved, spending my life in malice, envy, and hate. When I first saw this list, I thought, well, that's just like Romans 1. You start with being foolish, and then you disobey, and then finally you end up with terrible things like malice and envy and hate. That may be the case, but I think all these terms almost imply a person who needs help. Even the malice there, their life is just spent in this because they can't get out. They're enslaved. They're trapped in that. Similar to what Paul tells Timothy in 2 Timothy 2. He said they've been taken snare by the devil. And you know, maybe all of us weren't ever really quite that depraved. That's what I struggle with, is how do you interpret that? I had pretty good parents. And they stayed together at least till we were all out of the house, and they taught us the Bible, they got us to church, and they put us in connection with other good people. I don't think I was ever those things. Well, let me tell you another way to think about it. Do you ever struggle with deception of others, with being disobedient, with hating other people, with envy? What I kind of think about is how, if I just let those temptations, which I confess to you I still have, and I let them go because I wasn't controlled in some measure by the Spirit through the Word, what would I be? Do you ever think about that? Those dark parts of you that you have to suppress all the time. Maybe y'all are better than me on this. But when I look at my dark side, I say, I could be that. I could be that in just a heartbeat. Right? And he's saying, think about that. When you look at how are you going to act this way toward those who are outside, think about what you could be, or were in some cases, but in even in the present, still struggle not to be. But he says, God's love and kindness appeared. And there, the word appeared is also found in chapter 2. The grace appeared. But here, his love and kindness appears. Because he's appealing to us to have love and kindness toward this corrupt culture. He said, God gave you some love and kindness, and now we're enlightened. And I put an exclamation point almost in jest here. Because it's easy, I think we may move from toleration then finally to contempt. Yes, they're not enlightened. They live in darkness. They're evil. They're bad people. And we're back into the sins that he's discussed earlier in the chapter. So he kind of defeats that to say, yes, we're enlightened, okay, but what we learned is that we didn't deserve any of it by our work. So you see, this is a slightly different argument than in chapter 2. Chapter 2 was, we're redeemed and therefore we should live consistent with that redemption as God's special people. But here he's making the argument, no, you don't even deserve what you have, and without the grace of God, you'd be just like them, so you better treat them in a proper way. You see the difference in those, although the story is the same. It's appeared to all men, as he says, and so we're enlightened. We didn't deserve it by our works. Our cleansing and hope of eternal life is just God's mercy and grace. And so that's the argument. And that's why he again has this story of redemption in all those glowing terms, just to remind us that the people we're supposed to act this way toward, seems difficult, are really just like us. And the only reason we're not like them is not our own merit, not our own credit, not our own works that we do in righteousness, but rather the works that God has done for us. And so, verse 14 is a great verse, it seems to me. He mentions our people. I don't know for sure I think it's verse 14. Yeah, verse 14 mentions that, but verse 8. God should be careful to maintain good. These are good and profitable men. Verse 14, let our people learn to maintain good works, to meet urgent needs that they may not be unfruitful. Now, the word people is interpolated in verse 14, but he says those who believe in God in verse 8, and then he says our people, verse 14. Does that sound exclusive, like only our kind? All the translators say our people. There's something special about our people. And we are different from the world. And we're different in what we do and think and say and know for sure, only because of what God has done for us. And we're different in the way we treat them. We're different in the way we live among those who are not our people, I guess is the way to say it. I want to conclude by going back to chapter 2 and look at that sense of living in the present age as God's people. The grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness, worldly lust, we should live soberly, righteously, godly in the present age. What is the present age? It's tough for us. It had to be tougher for those who were in Crete. That's the present age we live in. It's not our age because we're looking for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our great God and Savior Jesus Christ. Another appearing, so to speak, that breaks into this world, who gave himself for us that he might redeem us from every lawless deed, as in the world around us, again, an emphasis on works perhaps, and purify him for himself his own special people, zealous again, in an era, in a time, in a culture, on an island of people who are lazy gluttons, but we are zealous for good works in what we do because of what he's done for us. I'm going to offer the invitation now to become part of God's special people and have access to the sacrifice of Jesus. If you need to do something in a public way, we'd encourage you to come as we stand and sing.